And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. It is 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 2nd of February, 2024. You're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show, and it is a Friday. Coming up a little later on, Seamus Gunn's going to be joining us to answer your legal questions. So you can use the opportunity now to get in touch if you wish. 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. You can watch the show, of course, on your smart TV or your Fire Stick or Google TV. Just go to the YouTube app, type in Highland Radio Ireland, and we're across all your mobile devices as well on Facebook, Highland Hub, Highland Radio News and Sport, and stay in touch with us. All right, let's say good morning to our guests today as we look over some of the big stories of the week. We'll say good morning first to Dr. Peter O'Rourke, a retired consultant orthopaedic surgeon. Good morning to you, Peter.
Morning, Greg.
Great to have you on board as always. Lorraine Thompson's the Regional Director of the Donegal Youth Services. Hi, Lorraine.
Morning, Greg.
Good morning. I feel like it's ages since we've had you on. It's great to have you back.
It's been a while. Yeah, I've been busy, Greg, but I'm back now.
Well, it's not for the want of us asking you. And also Councillor Jack Morrison, Fein Councillor in the Municipal District of Inishowen. Good morning to you, Jack.
Morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. Okay. I suppose the big story of the week, devolved government in Northern Ireland will be restored after a 24-month hiatus following a decision by the DUP. It had been blocking the work of an assembly and executive over concerns about post-Brexit trade arrangements. But now the DUP has agreed to re-enter the institutions after an agreement which saw the UK government pass new legislation at Westminster at breakneck speed, indeed. The deal has been agreed, but the practicalities of kicking devolution back into gear are still playing out, but it should be all done and dusted by tomorrow. I'll stay with you, Jack. Jack Murray, I mean, obviously, this is good news, and particularly good news for the people of Northern Ireland.
Absolutely, and it's long overdue. It's something they've been waiting on for about 2 years now. I think it's good for workers, for the people of the up north of Ireland. And I'd say it's about time, and all the parties are meeting today to finalise agreements, and hopefully Stormont will sit tomorrow. And we've seen the consequences of strike action across the north, and the demands of the hundreds of thousands of public sector workers there. So hopefully that'll all be resolved. The action can be taken, money be put back in their pockets, and services can be delivered at the highest standard, hopefully across the north. And I suppose it's a very historic day, very significant, in that we will have an Irish Republican sitting as First Minister of North of Ireland in a state that was designed for that to never happen. So, and of course, Michelle O'Neill will be acting to represent all people of the six counties of all traditions. But nonetheless, it's extremely significant. For the first time ever, it will be a unionist sitting in that office. So like, it's welcome all around, but it's hugely, hugely significant.
Do you think it will last? I mean, obviously, there is a lot of infighting, it would appear, within the DUP on this. Some seeing it as a surrender deal, as a sellout, but maybe enough of the view that this is the only way forward for the DUP and the Assembly.
I hope it does. I can't predict what's going to happen. I hope it does. I think it's the best for everybody. And in the north, I suppose that question is better put to like Geoffrey Donaldson, if he can keep everybody in tow. Obviously, there's very disgruntled elements and the extreme elements of loyalism that are going to try and disrupt this and going to try and bring it down. I hope that Donaldson and his people can do enough to convince the elements of unionism as to the merits of keeping a dissolved assembly and to deliver services for all the people, because We've seen how negative an impact the collapse of the Assembly had on the people in the north. So hopefully it'll hold strong, and we'll be doing everything we can. Michelle O'Neill will be doing everything she can in the Office of First Minister to represent everybody of all traditions and to convince them of the need of directly locally elected representatives.
And finally, just before I bring in our other guests, did you ever think this day would come?
I always believed it will come. I've been involved in politics for a good 20 years, trying to work towards this day coming. I've been involved in different constituencies in the north. So I've been active in different election campaigns, and I've always been optimistic. So I've always believed that we could have a first minister in the north. I do believe we can have a Taoiseach in the south as well, and ultimately working towards a portion of there.
Lorraine Thompson, I mean, you know, a lot of people criticise governments all around the world, but I think really for any country, you need a functioning government, and we've seen the negative impacts on Northern Ireland there has been over the last 2 years, not least in, you know, public sector pay, but also investment in education and health and just having people that are actually representing the people on the ground. So it is a good day if they finally get it over the line.
Yes, I think so. It's hard to believe that there hasn't been a government in place for 2 full years. You do wonder who's going ahead making decisions and how many decisions have been delayed as a result of not having a sitting government. If any of us stepped away from our positions for 2 years, time moves on and people are left wanting and waiting. I would imagine behind the scenes you have the public servants getting on with it and doing the jobs that they're paid to do. But within that, being harangued and not being able to progress decisions, I can't imagine what it's like for the people of Northern Ireland sitting for 2 full years waiting on that. So yes, I would say it's absolutely welcome. And I hope, as Jack has said, that now they're there, they'll be able to get on with things. I'm not a politician, obviously, but reading between the lines, I see there's a lot of disgruntlement there. But I think there's an 80-page document. I haven't read it, obviously, myself, but the devil's in the detail. But yeah, I think if they put the people first, that's what they need to do. Put the people first, get the services that need to be back on track, and hopefully get some kind of stability.
Yeah, and as you say, the devil's in the detail, but often that detail's open to interpretation, and you can always frame it, I suppose, in a certain way to match what you want. But hopefully it's not enough to derail what seems to be going on now. Peter O'Rourke, there are some that might say, really, that you know, they had to be blackmailed into government by the withholding of money, and maybe Northern Ireland was doing okay without a government. I don't know.
I don't think it was doing that well without a government. I think that the most important thing is, once the executive starts sitting again, is get all the bits of legislation, all the money they need to from Westminster, and get the services up and running, and improve the pay structures for all the various public body workers in the north. I wouldn't hold out much hope that it will last for a hell of a long time. I think unionism is so fractured. Having grown up at a time when there was a unionist party, 40 or 50 years ago. Now it's so fractured that all it will take is something like this and disgruntlement for the DUP to suddenly become the small unionist party and a more extreme form of unionism to come to the fore, and then come an election, which I think is due in the next 12 months or so, and you'll end up in the same situation. So I just hope that whatever time the executive is actually functioning, they get a lot done, because I wouldn't hold much hope that in a year's time there'll still be a functioning executive. But that's me being cynical.
Some within unionism say that this deal and the concessions from the British government actually ensure that we won't see a united Ireland any time soon. Others say the events over the last number of years means we're edging ever closer to a united Ireland. And quite interesting that that conversation is being had just as they're about to get over the line and back into government together. Do you have an opinion, Peter, as to whether or not this is easing us closer to united Ireland or not?
I don't think it will make an awful lot of difference. It'll harden attitudes of the people who are very much against a united Ireland. And once that happens, it'll slow progress. But ultimately, I think nothing's going to happen in the short term. And, you know, throwing the arguments out now probably doesn't help the situation, especially as the Assembly is just getting back into to function again. But the devil is in the detail. And the one thing nobody has really mentioned is whether this 80-page document is going to be acceptable to the EU. So, I mean, that's the other reason I think it's important that they get as much done as they can in the next month or two, because the EU might throw a spanner in the works, because, as with everything, an 80-page document, the devil is in the detail, and sometimes the details may be not acceptable to everybody.
Jack, your party leader this week spoke of us edging towards a united Ireland. Do you allow yourself a time frame in your mind for when you think that might happen?
Well, I'd like to see it in the next decade. Of course, I've got a solid plan to process to make for as peaceful a transition as possible. But as I said before, Michelle O'Neill in the office of the First Minister is a fairly decent woman. I know her well, but I think she has a huge role to do in this now. She needs to show the respect, the mutual respect that an Irish Republican can do in that office, and show unionism that they've nothing to fear from the United Ireland. Show them that their traditions, their culture, their nationality, so be it, will be welcomed and cherished in the United Ireland. And I do think she will act as a First Minister for all and show that the future can be bright in such an island.
All right, quick break and more from Lorraine, Peter and Jack after these. Caller says Northern Ireland can only had a government for 2 years out of 10 because of Sinn Féin and the DUP. Another caller says, this week I listened to people wanting to ban vapes, but there was debates in the Dáil about legalising cannabis. This country is good crack. Quick one on that. I mean, Lorraine, they keep trying to have the conversation about legalising drugs, not just cannabis, actually. Do you have a view on that? It is kind of interesting that we're talking about vapes bad, you know, cannabis not so bad.
Well, in relation to the debate about vapes, I think the interesting part of that for me is the environmental approach getting it over the line as opposed to the health approach. You know, so the fact that you can buy a disposable vape for, I think, it's something like €5 or €8 or something like that, and they're throwaway and they're impacting on the environment, never mind people's health. We've always known that cannabis, for example, is a gateway drug. For vapes now,
people don't really like when it's described as a gateway drug. Those that are in favour of its decriminalisation say that that's not the case. Lots of people drink and they don't necessarily go on to do other stuff.
Yes, I guess there's a school of thought for both there. But in relation to the vapes and having the THC within it, you know, the fact that young people, for example, could be buying vapes or getting vapes, acquiring vapes, you know, and they don't realise what's in it. In relation to legalising cannabis, there's that notion of, you know, people having their own personal supply, and that would take it off the black market. And I know there's loads of health information there around its availability for things like sleep and anxiety and stuff like that. So I do think there's a school of thought there. If it was legalised, it could be maybe legislated for better so that people would have better access to it. You know, we have obviously all the CBD oils, you can get them in different countries and stuff like that. And I see a lot of people like moving towards ones that would have more potency. Yeah. So I think, yeah, there is definitely an argument for legalising it.
I think we'd all sort of agree that disposable vapes in particular, or anything that sort of encourages the access to vaping to young people, needs to be done away with. Peter, do you have a view on that ongoing old chestnut of whether cannabis should be legalised?
I don't know that it would make a hell of a difference. I mean, if it was legalised, you'd still get people having an illegal market for it because the illegal market might be cheaper. It's like cigarettes. The amount of people we hear being coming through Dublin Airport with suitcases with tens of thousands of cigarettes from Eastern Europe, which are cheaper. So even if you did legalise it, I don't know that it would do away with the illegal drug trade. It is effectively a gateway drug, and it's in the same way as vaping can be lead on to cigarette smoking as well, because having seen people outside bars having a cigarette and then when they finish the cigarette having a vape, I think vapes were brought in supposedly for health reasons to stop people smoking. That didn't work.
The only thing about that is though, we allowed, if there is an argument for that, we allowed for years, the Americans did this 6 or 7 years ago, we allowed them to market particular flavours, sexy designs, front of house advertising, advertising right behind the person serving you in the shop. That to me was shameful, really, because now we don't even really have a full knowledge of how many young people are vaping, but a lot of them are vaping. And nicotine addiction, and I know this, nicotine addiction, it stays with you forever, even if you don't continue to take nicotine. It's sad. I find it really sad for them.
It's ironic because nicotine is a toxin. It's a poison. It's a neurotoxin. Yet in small doses, people find it enjoyable. But I think it just goes to show you the power of three big groups, big pharmacy, the petrol companies, and the cigarette companies. I mean, for years in America, I remember seeing an ad from the 50s, which was portrayed with doctors smoking in their white coats with stethoscopes around their neck outside a hospital, advertising a brand called Springfield, the cigarette smoked by doctors. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is. The cigarette industry knows that cigarettes were bad for years, but they still promoted them. They're now getting into the vaping industry. And when you go into a shop now and see hundreds, in a small shop, you'd see hundreds of different types of vapes for as little as three for a tenner. I mean, it's big business. It's big money. Shopkeepers are making money out of it. The companies are making money out of it. So good luck trying to stop it. You may limit it in some ways, but you're never going to stop it. They've let the cat out of the bag and they're never going to get it back in.
Jack, do you have a position on the legalization or decriminalization? Or I really don't know what status we're in at the moment, but as it relates to cannabis use?
Yeah, well, I'm fairly agnostic on it. I know the Constitutional Assembly is going to discuss and make recommendations, but I think there is an argument for regulation, protection of it. I don't think there's any use in stigmatizing those who use it or criminalizing those who use it. I think there's plenty of international examples where there's been a lot of good by regulation, taking it away from the drugs trade, internet, or black market, taking on board everything that Peter said as well, obviously. But I do think there's room for it to make it safer, and rather leaving it in the hands of criminals to control.
Or just try and do more to deter people from taking it to begin with try and stop it getting into the country. That's another angle.
Oh, and I have to say that the drug trade is just a scourge on our communities. It's becoming more and more widespread. We know that more and more young people are using not just cannabis, but also cocaine is now rampant within our communities. And that needs to be tackled head on. The criminal gangs that are controlling that need to be taken head on. And look, people need to be educated not to get involved in the first place. But I still do believe that there probably is room for regulating, making safer something that does exist in communities at this moment in time.
It does exist, that's true. The deposit return scheme got underway this week. It's aiming to tackle single-use waste and reduce litter. The scheme will see the price of products sold in eligible containers increase. However, the deposit can be reclaimed by returning the container to designated drop-off locations, which have been established at retailers around the country. The initiative applies to PET plastic bottles and steel and aluminium cans with a capacity between 150ml and 3 litres. But there has been criticism, of course. Small businesses say it leaves them at a disadvantage. Many can't afford these machines, while people who recycle at home will now be encouraged to collect that waste and then potentially drive to a shop to recycle. There's a lot of people get their shopping delivered to them. There is no return system through that means, if you know what I mean. Will it achieve the aim the Greens are saying, Lorraine, of reducing litter and increasing recycling? We heard from a minister yesterday, the Green minister, suggesting that that people who now currently drive around our beautiful county chucking bottles out of the window along with their fast food wrappers and all of that will now instead put them on the back seat and go to their local shop and stick them in a hole for 15 cents. Do you think that's going to happen, Lorraine?
You sound very cynical there. Right?
I am, actually, to be honest with you. I can't believe I didn't mask that better.
I'm interested to see how it plays out. I think like everything, there's going to be some teething problems. I think it's a good thing, first of all. I think the people that throw their litter out the window will continue to throw their litter out the window. I think that's a particular mindset of a person that does that. That's why I don't think this is going to change them. That being said, listen, we're going to have to pay more for these bottles and cans. So it's in our best interest to bring them back to whatever shop we're going to. You know, we are all now driving around, well, pretty much all of us, with plastic bags in our boots. We never thought we would do that. But we've got into the habit of it, you know, when they brought in the plastic bag levy.
Reusable bags, you mean, don't you? Yep.
Oh, the plastic reusable
ones. Yeah, okay, get you. Yeah. They're forever
basically
bags.
Basically any plastic bag, yep. Greg, to be honest.
True,
when you go to the supermarket,
you bring them with
whatever's
you.
In the boot. And I see this being the same. Listen, I've been curious about these machines when I'm popping in and out of grocery shops, wondering what they were about. Did a wee bit of reading about it this week. And I do think, listen, it's about creating good habits. And I'm in favour of that. I'm in favour of anything that's going to help the environment. You know, as a householder myself, I try and, you know, make sure all the right stuff goes into the blue bin. You know, sometimes you're wondering, is this, you know, should it be here, should it be there? But this is very clear cut, you know, in terms
of... But Lorraine, you are obviously a model citizen and you're already, you're already placing your plastics and your aluminium in the recycle bin. With the knowledge, I presume you'd be hoping that they are going on to be recycled and turned into new bottles and cans. Are you not being punished, or maybe someone who is a little bit more religious in the recycling, then are you not being punished with a new scheme on top of that that actually discourages you from putting these things into your bin?
I don't see it as discouragement. I mean, I think if it's bringing everybody together, you know, and it's fostering a curiosity with kids, which where, you know, good habits really should start, you know, that they get into the habit for their generation to come of bringing these back to the supermarkets. I mean, it's a bit of an inconvenience, you know, having to put them into whatever bag and remember to bring them back. Obviously, it's the additional cost. But as I say, that's what they did with the plastic bag levy. I think it has worked by and large. But it's just, it's new behaviours. And I think if, you know, more people get on board with this, it's a good thing.
You see, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm kind of softening my view a little bit with the way you've articulated it about younger people and what have you. And we do know back in the past we did recycle stuff. I think it's when ministers come on and say that it's going to stop people throwing stuff out the windows that sort of builds my cynicism. But I can kind of get on board with where you're coming from, Lorraine. You should, you know, maybe work for the government. Peter O'Rourke, what's your view?
I think anything that helps the environment and increases recycling is a good idea. I think the charges are a little bit excessive, but I suppose they have to be excessive to make it work. But if you're out about walking about town and you buy a bottle of a mineral or a can of a mineral, are you going to carry the can around all day and bring it home? You're going to end up throwing it in a bin somewhere. So an awful lot of the stuff that carries the levy is not going to be recycled. So there's an awful lot of money that someone's going to make on it, presumably the government. But the one thing I think that could happen and possibly would be a very good thing if charities set up large bins in areas where people could put things in and the charities could get the money. If you've ever been sitting at a roadside cafe in anywhere around Europe, and you'll see someone, unfortunately on hard times, walking along with a supermarket trolley asking you if you've finished your bottle of Coke at the table, can they have the bottle, because they're bringing it back to recycle it. So that has been going on in Europe for probably the last 10 years. But I think there is a potential here for charities to benefit from it rather than potentially the government benefiting from the levies that don't ever actually get returned to the purchaser.
Yeah, because the sugar tax was applied to these drinks and I didn't really notice any difference in that, or did it discourage anyone from buying sugary drinks? But we can all be sympathetic, can we not, Peter, to the small businesses. These machines can cost north of €30,000. There's grants available about €6,000. They can opt out to some extent, but, you know, obviously the big boys, in inverted commas, you know, they've already had the machines in for 6 months and what have you. Do you sympathise with the smaller businesses? Would this have been a better scheme if the government had sort of made a little bit more money available for the smaller shop owners?
I don't really think it would make a lot of difference. I mean, if you're a small shop owner and you're selling someone a can of Coke, they're not going to stand in the shop, drink it, put it into the machine and get their 15 cents back on the spot. You're going to be walking around the street when you've finished your drink, and then it's a case of, do I hold on to this can till I go back tomorrow and get a 15-cent discount on my next can? Having small shops do it, people aren't going to be doing one can at a time or one bottle at a time and carrying around little receipts till they accumulate enough to go in and purchase something else. I mean, it's like going to the bottle bank. You don't go every day. You go every 3 months when you're embarrassed, and you go in the dead of night so people can't see how much you've actually been drinking.
And wrap the bottles of wine in bubble wrap plastic so they don't make too big a bang. Jack, what do you think?
Look, I think it's worth going. I don't think Ireland's breaking any new ground on this. It's 14 EU countries have already implemented. It's proven to be going quite well. Again, I think it's great for children to encourage them to recycle that could be a fee to go back to bring their cans back to the shop and they might get sweets in return for it. I think that is good from an educational point
of view. More sugar. Excellent.
Sugar-free.
I know what you're saying. I do understand what you're saying.
One worry I would have is the advantage it'll give to larger supermarkets over the small corner shops, because if they have the big, large machines, if you're going to those shops to return your cans, you might be more likely to buy your liter of milk there rather than small corner shop that doesn't have the same facility. So there's a wee bit of kind of worry I would have in that regard. But look, it's worked in 14 other European Union countries. I don't think it can't work here either.
Yeah, but I mean, again, I just feel we in a border area are a bit of collateral damage here in that there's no accommodation for any drinks that happen to be bought in Strabane if you happen to drink them in Lifford. The aim is to help reduce litter on our roads. I'm not saying for a second that these cans come out of Northern Ireland or it's Northern Irish people that are dumping them. I would say there'll be an awful lot of cans and bottles in circulation in Donegal that can't be recycled anyway. And again, it's just like, and the minister said yesterday, he says, look, that's not ideal, right? And maybe we can get the North to do something similarly. But again, it's just another measure that really, it's for the many and not the few. And we're often us here along the border are the few that we just have to go along with it anyway.
As we talked about earlier, we're sitting in some assembly. Maybe that's something that we addressed there. Now that that's working. There's going to be loads of disadvantages to this. There's going to be loads of reasons for that to happen. But I do think we need to improve our recycling. We need to look after the environment. And I think it's worth a go. With all those kind of worries aside, I think it's worth it.
All right, you know.
I do think, Greg, just to say, in terms of litter, people who are prone to throwing things out the car window, if they spent 1 hour in their local area and took a black plastic bag out in a litter picker, they wouldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, of course. I can't get myself into the mind of someone that chucks that stuff out of the window. I mean, they're in their own area. Do you know what I mean?
Some of the stuff, I mean, we have done it here with community cleanups, and some of the stuff that people fire out their windows is awful.
Yeah, I've heard the stories. All right, you're welcome back to the programme. I've just been informed, actually, that there's going to be some announcements from Pope Francis a little later on as it relates to bishops, and we would know that Bishop Alan McGuckian is incredibly popular. He's been up here for quite some time, but he is likely to be on the move. We'll talk to you about that. Bring you more about that a little later on in the programme. But it seems that he may be moving to be Bishop of Down and Connor. A caller says, I remember when young, growing up in London, calling at houses to collect bottles of mineral to return the off-licence and get the reward of the deposit. This will take bottles off the road as it will be money maker for young people. Will the government tax them, though? Hi, regarding the new bottle system, can you just collect them and return at the end of the month to any shop, or do you need to return the bottle to the shop you bought it in? Would make sense that these can be returned to any shop regardless where you bought it and possibly have them outside like a clothing bank. Well, a lot of them are outside. Particularly with the bigger stores, and you can return them wherever you like, providing they have that recycle logo on them. Like Denmark, we need a referendum on new EU migration pact to regain control of mass immigration policy. It's harming the prospects of our own children and grandchildren. We are looking to opt out of that and pay fines, but we talked about that early in the week, and we'll talk about it again later in the week. Hi, Greg. What will be done with the excess millions unclaimed money for recycling? It'll be ring-fenced for something or other, and we'll never know, perhaps. But listen, we'll find out. We'll find out. We're heading into that time of the year when the annual exodus of ministers and councillors or heads of council reps, they head to far-flung parts of the world. It comes into scrutiny, of course. A total of 35 government ministers and ministers of state are travelling abroad for meetings and events relating to St Patrick's Day, along with Cam Corla, Seana Fáil, Cathaoirleach of the Shannon, Jerry Bottomer, and Attorney General Rosa Fanning. Green ministers' flights will rack up almost 11 tonnes of carbon emissions on St Patrick's Day trips to Brazil, the US, the Far East and other locations this year. That's the equivalent, just for the Green ministers, of a year's worth of emissions for two average family cars. Peter O'Rourke, can you understand why this might upset people, or do the ends justify the means?
The ends justify the means. Every country in the world would love to have a St. Patrick. I mean, when you think about, you know, the rivers in America being turned green on St. Patrick's Day, the Sydney Opera House being covered in green light during St. Patrick's Day, It is an incredibly strong promotional tool for Ireland. And, you know, the minister may be going on junkets, but any country in the world would give their eye teeth to have something as beneficial as that, giving you open access. I mean, when you think of it, every year the Taoiseach gets open access to the White House and sits down with the President of America. No country in the world would, you know, give up
on that. But where's the benefit for regular people? Like, I mean, that's the argument we hear all the time. But, you know, people are struggling with the cost of living. They're seeing their young children emigrate. They can't afford homes. Like, at what point will this fantastic dividend from ministers flying all over the world be actually felt by your average person?
Well, you never feel it individually, but I mean, the fact that you have access to politicians from other countries, you can do business, the IDA are part of these groups, and it is very big. I was in Vietnam for Patrick's Day last year, and there was a big reception in a hotel. I wasn't at it because I wasn't there long enough, but all the local dignitaries were there, and access to business people, to government, etc., would not be possible in the same way any other time of the year. So I think it's a no-brainer that it's good for Ireland. People may, you know, give out about all the ministers going on junkets, but believe me, I mean, if you're traveling to, say, China, some of the ministers are, for a 2 or 3 day trip, and you're spending 24 hours in the plane, or if you're going to Australia or New Zealand to do the same, and then getting jet lag, coming back for a similar 24 hours in the plane and getting jet lag again, believe me, it's work. It's not sort of a jolly in the sense that people think it is.
Mm. Okay, Lorraine Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, Greg. I actually feel like I was maybe on your show in previous years talking about.
Oh,
the
we do
CMT.
It every year. Yeah, we do this
it
every
comes
year.
Up every year. Yeah, I mean, I get the two sides of the argument. My personal opinion is I think that the trips are worthwhile. Now, I mean, how forensically you want to drill down into the impact, you know, in terms of, you know, people on the ground and how they feel that impact. I need to do a research project into that to see, mm-hmm. you know, have they opened more doors? Have they increased opportunities for Irish people? I think this year is the biggest year from what I read of the ministers travelling so many different countries. I didn't realise they went to so many different countries. I'm with Peter in terms of if other countries could have a St. Patrick's Day, it's great. It opens doors for us as a very, very small country and kind of brings us out there. It's fantastic. Other countries celebrate it. Just goes to show how many Irish people are all over the world. You know, and it hones everything back to here. But like I say, I get it. This year, obviously, with the Palestinian crisis and the debate about, you know, whether, you know, there should be visits to the White House. I do think sometimes it's better to be in the room than out of the room to be able to have that conversation because you can't have it if you're not in the room.
I mean, that's obviously talking to some of the calls that for us to boycott Washington in support of the plight of the Palestinian people. But you believe that you're far better off to use those channels, keep them open to try and influence international policy?
Yes, and I would like to think that our Irish politicians are going out with that agenda, you know, and I think that's the opportunity that they have, as Peter has said, in the room for whatever duration that is, to put forward that agenda and to put it forward very strongly.
Is it too cheap an argument then, or is it a fair enough argument? There are people listening to this programme who are we're bombarded every day and told every day, you know, about the environment, how we need to protect the environment, how we have to make sacrifices, how we have to pay extra taxes. We've even told to take individual responsibility in how often we fly abroad. You know what I mean? That we have a responsibility in that regard. It does make that messaging more difficult when half the dole is flying all over the world and we're being told the message is that don't worry about it because there's long-term dividends. We can't actually define what they are, but you have them. You'll feel them maybe. I don't know.
I think they should be able to define them. And I don't know, has there been any longitudinal studies on this? But I think, I mean, there should be an opportunity to be able to track maybe you know, some of those visits to something more concrete and more tangible here. That's what I'm saying. I get the argument in terms of the impact on the environment and the cost and all of that, but does the end justify the means? I mean, I'm guessing these planes are going anyway. They're not hiring private jets.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting on airlines that are going.
But for me to have a 3-litre SUV and to fly abroad 3 or 4 times a year, the ends justify the means because it makes me happy and it's good for my, you know, my mental and physical health. I get loads of vitamin D. You know, I mean, if we want to justify anything, we can really,
yeah,
can't
we? How articulate you are, though.
Yes, I suppose. Jack Murray, what do you think?
I agree with everything you said. You could argue it's a bit excessive. I think we're going to very obscure countries. So I don't know about the likes of, like, Zambia and South Sudan, Ethiopia, and the entire cabinet table almost is gone. So there's an argument that that's fully a bit excessive. But I do think there is merit, particularly on the points being made in America. We're the only country in the world that has guaranteed audience with an American president for one day of the year.
And what is the benefit of that? Sorry. What is the benefit?
Yeah, the tangible benefits we've seen over the peace process and the Brexit negotiations, we've seen that Irish America stood up and intervened when we needed them. We've seen the interventions of like so Senator Richie Neal and Nancy Pelosi, who came to the door and stood up for us against the British government at the time, who wanted to drive a hard border a couple of miles from where I'm sitting right now. That was long, painstaking diplomacy by different Irish politicians, different political parties. Because if we abandoned that access that we have, the British government would be the only people talking to the American government, and we probably wouldn't have had.
Okay,
that
but that's all what's in it for us, and that's great. But I wonder how it might look to the people of Palestine, who us, you know, hobnobbing, whining and dining with the people that are, you know, not using their influence to try and stop it in a meaningful way, providing weapons, providing sort of international diplomatic cover to Israel. I mean, at what point do we say, right, this is really good for us, but let's get on the right side of history here. Let's make or take a moral stance. Your own party leader's heading over for the same, and you say, yeah, we'll express our dissatisfaction with what's happening in the Middle East, but we're also going over there to have our palms greased. And when I say our palms, I don't mean individually. I mean us as a nation.
No, absolutely. Obviously, this is an issue of concern. It's dominated a lot of the media, and I'm speaking to a lot of people who are concerned about that. I'll say this. I've been to Palestine. I've been to a refugee camp in Palestine. The refugee camp, which has just seen 3 children shot the night before I arrived. I've seen the apartheid state of Israel in action. Like everybody else, since October, I watched genocide unfold on my TV screen. So it's something I feel extremely strongly about. Now, I want my party leader to go over and look Joe Biden in the white of his eye and tell him that Ireland, that he is so fond of, is horrified by his country's military support of this genocidal regime. Now, I think if we were to boycott it now, it would be domestic news in Ireland for a day. But if we can go over to the biggest political arena in the world and tell CNN, Fox News, all the world media, that the Irish people are horrified at the American support, military support for a genocide in the Middle East, I think that is much, much more powerful.
And you're saying Mary Lou McDonald, if invited, is going to go on to American TV and use that strong language against the Americans?
Mary Lou McDonald has made it absolutely clear that she's going to use this as an opportunity to voice her support for the people of Gaza and an end to what has happened. The Palestinian ambassador to Ireland has asked that this is raised while there. She speaks on behalf of the Palestinian people, so I think we should take her guidance on this matter. But again, I have to say, if we were to boycott this, it would be a domestic news story in Ireland for a day, and nobody else would hear about it.
Yeah, but these people represent us as a nation, and some of us as a nation aren't actually interested in news cycles. We're actually interested in this country doing the right thing. Politicians and parties are interested in news cycles because that's what determines their popularity or otherwise. But we as the population of this country perhaps need to be heard. What do we think? What's right for us? What's right for the people that claim to represent us in terms of their actions?
Yeah, and that's the point I'm making. I think we should be standing up for the people who we represent. Because I'm getting, like, every day, people are contacting me about this and the horror of what's happening. That's why I think we can intervene and make meaningful intervention at this moment in time. Like, if Marilyn McDonald and Michelle O'Neill didn't go out, Leo Varadkar is going out, and he would be the only voice on behalf of the Irish people. And I don't think that he would speak as strongly, and I hope he proves me wrong on that, but I don't think he would speak as strongly as Marilyn McDonald or Michelle O'Neill. So I think it's absolutely critical. On this, because everybody wants to stand up for Palestine. The only debate or disagreement on this is on diplomatic strategy, whether or not it's more powerful to boycott or whether or not it's to go over and intervene over there. And I do think we're more powerful in Washington.
Lorraine or Peter, anything to add just before we take the last break?
No, I agree with Jack 100%.
Yeah, I agree totally. It is unfortunate and it's very irritating that Irish people are being labelled as anti-Semitic when we're not. We're anti-Zionist, and basically that is the difference. But unfortunately, propaganda and PR basically tends to gel the line between the two, and they are very, very different.
Yesterday, we heard calls from a local councillor for the wearing of high-vis for walkers and cyclists to be mandatory. But some oppose the move, saying it's up to motorists to ensure they're driving in a way which allows them to see and respond to walkers or cyclists on the road. Peter O'Rourke, would you be in favour of it actually being the law for cyclists and walkers to wear high vis?
It's a no-brainer, yes. When you think that car drivers have to wear a seatbelt, cyclists should wear a helmet, and high vis is very important, especially in a rural county like Ireland or like Donegal, where there's an awful lack of footpaths. But it's one of my hobby horses. I mean, the RSA, to me, are a joke. They should be the ones promoting this. Instead, they show us ads with horrific accidents, which I must admit I turned to another channel. They show us ads telling drivers how to behave with cyclists who look like they've only just gone on a bike for the first time and expect you to give them so much room that you're driving in a ditch on the other side of the road. I mean, the RSA do not really do any good, and they're looking for an extra $6 million to promote things. I mean, they should be showing people how to drive on motorways. They should be telling cyclists how to behave. If you've ever been down in Dublin and watched a Deliveroo driver cyclist going through a traffic lights, you have pedestrians who think they can cross the road anytime they like without looking around, and it's the responsibility of the driver. I'm sorry, there needs to be a great rethink by the RSA, and they need to actually tell people other than car drivers how to behave on the road, because at times they're like a parody of George Orwell's Animal Farm, where four tyres bad, two tyres good.
I'll come back to you, Lorraine Thompson.
Yes, I think it should be mandatory. I'm just curious as to how that could be policed. It always blows my mind when we start having conversations about enforcing the law in relation to something that keeps people alive. You would think the fact that it keeps them alive would change their own behaviours. That being said, I know that maybe it's not cool, or I don't know. I really don't understand why people don't wear the high-vis vest. They're readily available. They're free. You can get them from the RSA and lots of different sources.
Well, they were out of stock yesterday, but anyway, go ahead.
Well, there you go. So I was looking at an RSA report there just before I jumped on, and I didn't realise that... in terms of pedestrian fatalities on the road, those aged 66 and over accounted for 51% last year. You know, I don't know what our association would be, that would be more younger people. That it took that 58% of them took place in urban roads, which I would imagine would have had pedestrian crossings and footpaths, you know, as opposed to this notion of it being in kind of more rural areas with no footpaths, and that nearly half of them took place between October and December. So obviously that idea of, you know, the dark nights and stuff like that. So there's stuff around people's behaviours, taking a chance, going out and getting caught out, I don't know, without their high-vis vest, not anticipating it's getting dark before they come home, or taking a chance and running across the road.
I think we see it so routinely, though. We see it so routinely, people walking in dark clothes, particularly. I haven't really come across cyclists too much, to be honest with you, and I'm on the road quite a bit, but particularly walkers, I think. Jack Murray, what do you think?
I agree with what everyone's said. I'm more in favour of the carrot than the stick and things like that. I do think that we should be encouraging more people, and the RSA really has a role to step up on it, maybe rather than the Gardaí at this moment of time. And basically, RSA were out in schools giving out more high-vis vests, and cycling clubs giving out more high-vis gear. Obviously, no cyclist should be out without a light, without a helmet, without being properly visible. I don't know the merit of handing it over to the Gardaí and getting it to police it and stop handing out fines every time they see somebody. Like, we should be encouraging people to look after themselves rather than enforcing it.
But we do have to enforce seatbelt wearing. You know, we don't just sort of try and carrot and not stick that. So
Well, I suppose the guinea pig in this is Italy. This has, I think, it's the first country to bring in the mandatory high-vis vest, and they've reported no change in the number of fatalities with cyclists pedestrians on the back of it. So it hasn't worked there. I'm not sure of the merits of it. I'm not opposed to it, but I always think the carrot is more powerful than the stick. But
Peter, I think sometimes we, because of the frequency of tragedy on our roads and because of the size of our country, I think sometimes, for probably the right reasons, stops us having honest conversations about, you know, if someone dies in a car crash, were they wearing a seatbelt or not? Well, we can't really talk about that because we have to be sensitive about that, and I get that. And the same with pedestrians being knocked down or cyclists. Did they have a light or not? Were they wearing a high-vis or not? Did that contribute to it? You know, and Lorraine done a good job there of interpreting statistics, but she's having to interpret it because we never seem to be able to find the right time, because there's always just a tragedy that's passed. Maybe to have a really frank conversation about this and an honest one using proper information.
Well, the difficulty is I don't think you'll ever get the proper information. I mean, effectively, if there's ever an accident on the road, it is the driver who's responsible. So there isn't a lot of personal responsibility for many things in Ireland, but certainly if a pedestrian is hit by a car, it's the car's fault. If a cyclist is hit by a car, it's the car's fault. And unfortunately, when you have that sort of argument, then it's hard to persuade cyclists and pedestrians to actually behave themselves any better, because they never get blamed for anything. I mean, if you're in a courtroom and somebody's injured, it's the car which is insured, because the pedestrian isn't insured and the cyclist isn't insured. So in that circumstance, it's hard to persuade people that it's in their own best interests to be more careful.
Okay, Peter O'Rourke, Dr. Peter O'Rourke, retired consultant, orthopaedic surgeon. Thank you for your time as always. Have a wonderful weekend. Jack Murray, always a pleasure. Take care of yourself. Thank you very much indeed for your time this morning. And last but not least, Lorraine Thompson, Regional Director of the Donegal Youth Services. Thanks so much, Lorraine.
Thanks, Craig. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye. Take care of yourself. Okay, that was our Friday panel, and we have loads of your comments, which we'll carry over into the next hour. Coming up after the news and the obituary notices, we will be joined by Seamus Gunn. He's going to be answering your legal questions, so stay tuned for that, please. But we will take that break, and then we will be right back.